that's the golden time of day.
If you have questions or comments for Carol, our number here is 524-1080, 524-1080. And now, here's Carol.
Good morning and welcome to the Carol Cox Show. A lovely day here and quite excited. Again, this morning I got Mr. Ra Tam in with me, and former city councilman, former state senator, state representative. And we wanted to talk about the rail, but more importantly, there's also, I've received about six calls in the last 2 months and emails where people, just you and me and citizens who own property, are having problems either with the monstrous buildings or encroachment by the neighboring property. And so Ra Tam actually knows quite a bit about this and has a services. So in looking into permits and what have you, I have a shallow understanding of building and permits, but have dealt with the DPP extensively and many other issues. So I'm somewhat remotely aware of what the rules are. But some of the things that are presenting themselves are neighbors are saying, take, for example, in Haleiwa, there's a certain property, and the neighbors are concerned that there's activity going on, but when they look at the Department of Planning's Permit Office Posse website, they don't find any permits for the activity that these that is taking place or being undertaken by the owner or its contractors. So the owners are of the adjoining property who are being feel like they're being offended by either the water runoff or the exceeding the wall's height or the fences and all of those kinds of things. And I actually don't know what to say or do, because it should be clear. There are ordinance, there are rules and zoning rules, and there's an enforcement team at the Department of Planning and Permitting. It should be that simple. But apparently, not just this situation, but the giant apartment buildings or the monster buildings that are being built, whether it's in Kunia or what have you. So something's wrong. I understand in the old days they would actually cite you. So Ra Tam is here with me, and thank you for joining in on the Carol Cox Show. You can catch us at carolcox.com or go to Facebook, Carol Cox, or go to KWAI 1080 AM and listen to us live through the Internet. Rod, thank you for joining me.
Good morning, Carol. Very pleased to be here. Thank you for having this program whereby you're the advocate for the consumer out there, the people in general.
Yeah, but leave it to the government people. I'm not an advocate for anything. I'm a pain in the neck, and they want to know how can they make me go away. It's sad, you know.
Well, if it wasn't for people like you, we'd be in chaos, even more so in terms of government. And, you know, people ask me, why don't more people vote? I say, because they're frustrated with government. So
yeah.
What's the sense of voting? No matter if you have mail-in ballot voting, it doesn't make a difference because of the frustration. See, what happens is, in the days when I was in the legislature from 1982 to 2010, people had more acknowledgement or pride in their government mm-hmm. because the government was their government and it was mm-hmm. acting on their behalf. But today, they feel that government is not doing so why vote?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's up to government to prove themselves, quite frankly.
Right. So what is with these things that are presenting themselves where building goes up and the person expands the size of the building and you look on the website, the city's website, there's not an application or a building permit been filed or accepted or reviewed or anything. And many times there are warnings against the activity, but you still see the work being done. How can a adjoining tenant or a property owner who's being offended or their property is being impacted, what should they do?
Well, first of all, let me explain that you have two local governments here. You have the state of Hawaii and you have the city and county of Honolulu. The counties take care in terms of oversight of the building, homes, hotels, apartments, condominiums, and so forth. And each construction, whether it be a brand new construction or an addition, an expansion, is supposed to have a building permit, in this case, under the city and county of Honolulu.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about a city now. But what happens, there is supposed to be a building permit. And if it's not, then it's a violation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have inspectors under the city that go out and inspect, you know, where there's no building permit or there's a violation of the building code. We have a building code that's established by the city and county of Honolulu. And being the past chairman for the zoning committee and the planning committee of the city council, our building code falls in practice with the uniform building code for the nation, along
mm-hmm.
with the rules and regulations for the city and county of Honolulu.
And including some of the things that nationally standards is that gauge of wires and size of doors, is it that kind of
there's minimum standards. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, when I renovated my house back about 20 years ago, I built a ramp because my house is more on the hillside.
Mm-hmm.
And people said, why don't you build steps? I said, no, I want to build a ramp because you're to walk on a ramp rather than... and then, you know, people come up to my house, it's elderly, and so it's
mm-hmm.
easier to walk up rather than steps. The minimum required for a ramp width is 3 feet, or a sidewalk is 3 feet, but I made it 6 feet. People
mm-hmm.
thought I was crazy. I said, the building code establishes was the minimum standards.
Right.
Okay.
And then you can go beyond that within reason.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So what is some of the relief? For example, the people in Haleiwa, out that side, they tell me, we've called the inspectors, the inspector comes, and the offending property owner who they've complained about, the inspector gets out of the car and it's, hey, bruh, how you doing, bruh? How's it going, bruh? And they explained to me that's their belief in the system. I went south immediately because, you know, when the inspector coming to you complain about this particular party and the party that you complain about sees the inspector and it's, hey, brother, how you doing? How's the kids? How's the family? And, you know, and then nothing happens.
Well, basically, the building inspector was supposed to be neutral. He's supposed to be doing his job, despite in terms of whether he knows the person or not. If he does know the person, then he should ask the supervisor to have somebody else go inspect it so there's no conflict of interest as perceived.
Mm-hmm.
Also, too, there's a lack of building inspectors, to be honest with you.
Right.
The city council in the past has allotted money to the budget to have more building inspectors. But the mayor, throughout these years, especially under the current administration, Mayor Kirk Caldwell, has denied the request to hire more building inspectors. So they're kind of overworking. So you have all these telephone calls, complaints coming in, but there's only so many hours in a day, right? Mm-hmm. And there's no overtime allowed, basically. The mayor says, you can't have overtime because I want to cut the budget down.
Now, is it fair to say that, or speculate that our favorite subject, the rail, that what's the motivation or the incentive for the mayor to have money approved by the city council and then fail to use it? I mean, and when he got this gaping hole called the rail, do you think he just said, well, I'm not going to touch that even though they approved it. I'm going to leave it sitting there? Or is he actually using that money for the rail matters?
You know, I'm glad you asked that question because a lot of people don't understand the operations of the city and kind of know the state of Hawaii. And I'm a creature who learned about the administrative process beside the legislative process and the structure itself. Our governor and our mayor have this strange power. This power is whereby, in this case, the city council establishes the budget. Of course, the mayor puts his presentation in before they finalize it. And then the mayor says, well, I have the power under the city charter not to spend any money. Mm-hmm. You allocate in terms of funding for certain public services, but I desire not to spend. Mm-hmm. Okay, and he holds back. But he questions for those monies, quite frankly. It's a catch-22. You know, you question money, so why is it that he's holding back? Well, it could be one of the several things. One is that the council revenues, maybe the revenue projection didn't come out as so. But despite that, the mayor looks at it politically. If I can save money, basically, this year's budget, which is ongoing, then what can happen, like for example this year now, then he says, well, I'll show the city council that I have money, and therefore my next request for the next budget year, they will give me money for other services that I want.
Right.
So you play around with funds, basically.
Mm-hmm. Playing with funds for the fun of it, I guess, so that he can have a political edge on the next guy.
Yep.
Or the next girl that comes in pursuing or challenging him. Maybe he tries to rise to the level of congressman or senator or governor.
It makes the mayor look good in terms of, hey, I saved money. I have this pool of money now.
Mm-hmm.
So when he leaves office, the next mayor says, hey, I gave you money now. We're not in a deficit. But actually, in truth, the city and county of Honolulu is bankrupt.
So here's my suspicion. I believe we see this lack of enforcement on the monster buildings and the lack of enforcement in the adherence to the building code or regulating those that violate has a direct relationship between the rail and this, because there are many things that are falling short. Trash pickup, in a sense, is impacted by a lot of the rail issues. But one of the solutions that I was thinking, they have no problem in condemning property, eminent domain, for the rail, right?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Now, why is there such a debate on the mayor's part and let this gaping wound just continue to get worse and infected with this, just offending the people? Why not take the building and condemn it? It didn't meet the code. If it did meet the code, so we can't assure that it was safely erected and that it may present some legal problems, some threats to public safety and what have you. So why not just condemn the building and raise it?
They have that right. The city administration has that right. But first of all, they would do is they would notify the owner of the property or the contractor that you're in violation of the building code.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, well, we're going to fine you so much per day, and if you don't correct it, it'll give you some time, right? So the time is kind of arbitrary, basically. You know, if you can't establish in terms of rational reasoning and whereby you say, well, give me so much time, I have to correct in terms of the drawings and so forth that I can renovate. So, but then all in all, it could be months before something really happens physically to the building, which is a Munster home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's discuss in terms of what is the terminology or concept of a Munster home, basically. We're so used to it. I'm 64 years old. So, no such
thing. You're a young man.
Yeah.
I'm 65.
I'm going to be 65 this year, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, in October. But what happened is, when I was younger, we had homes of one-story building, right? And then we had two stories, okay? And you had a lot of open space around the house, right? So today, now you have larger homes. And then the standards for building these larger homes haven't really changed. Like, for example, the setback. Setback for a single level home is 5 feet from the boundary. The setback for two-level story home is 8 feet. Mm-hmm. That's really narrow, quite frankly, when you think about it. And I question it, too, because I've seen in terms of homes whereby it's almost like seeing they're touching the boundary line, but at 8 feet, you know.
Right.
And then you have the overhanging in terms of eaves of the house, and say, hey, that's not 8 feet setback.
Yeah, right. You have to have a setback of 8 feet, and you got the eaves sticking over in the neighbor's yard, which then introduces all the runoff of the water into the neighbor's yard, creating a problem for them, or especially on rainy days, rendering their property smaller, making it smaller for usage because the water is being dumped on there. So,
and then also, too, you know, the requirement is that you can have one kitchen within a dwelling.
Mm-hmm.
But you can have many bar sinks within that building.
So
you can have two-story building, and you have one kitchen, but you can have, say, two bar sinks. And
the
kitchen consists of three elements.
The sink, refrigerator,
and stove.
Right.
So you only have two that's considered a bar area.
Right.
So you may have a house that's Munster home, per se, or they call it Munster home. You have, say, two bar areas and one kitchen, right? And somebody sneaks in terms of a microwave. A microwave is considered a stove, basically, a clean utility.
And what they do, they have doors. They say, oh, there's all kinds of ways of getting around it by renting a little room and saying, well, just put a microwave in there and you have a bar sink.
Right. And you bring in a compact refrigerator, freezer, right, yeah.
And that becomes a rental.
Right.
But
right.
The city goes there and scratches its head and going, well, we don't really understand what's going on. And then the neighbors call and complain again. Mm-hmm. And the neighbors aren't, they tell me they're not really being picky or complaining, you know, meddling. It's just that house was built there and the cul-de-sac, let's say, can only carry so many cars. There's only so much room for cars in there. But if you have a monster house now, that monster house overwhelms the existing parking stalls along the street. So now you got disruption.
You know, interesting you mentioned that, because in the days of before, when you and I were younger, each family had at least only one car.
Right.
And so you see in terms like Lusitania in my area, you see a one-car garage, right? And that was in days of the mid-1950s, basically.
Right.
Or 1960s, at least. Today, every family has at least two cars.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that there are a little over 800,000 people living on Oahu, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But there are over 1 million cars. And it's so easy to buy a car because people put themselves in debt. You can buy a car with no down payment. You can put a car with, say, $2,000 down payment. And then you see new cars, dealerships set up in different communities. Well, a lot of these cars have been repossessed. Okay?
Right.
But anyway, what happened is the building code has not changed for parking requirements for one single-family dwelling. It's been 1.5 parking spaces. You know, how they had 1.5 parking space doesn't make sense, but
right.
It's basically it's one parking space. But they should have changed it because of the people buying more cars and you have multiple families living there. You have three generations, the grandparents, the children, and the grandchildren living there. So maybe you need a minimum of 2 requirement parking spaces or 3.
Right, but the existing roadway will only accommodate, and the roadways are built as well.
Yeah,
based on that equation.
Right,
but
basically, it's a fault in terms of the law itself. It hasn't kept up with the time.
Mm-hmm.
Also, too, I visited Japan as a diplomat when I was a city councilman 3 times. Okay, I was invited by the Japanese government to formulate international relationships. Although I'm Chinese, but you have to know in terms of the mannerism how to work with people, basically
right.
internationally. But anyway, in Japan, it's very interesting. Within a city area or town area, no cars are allowed on the street. You have to have a private parking space.
Mm-hmm.
So you eliminate this overuse of the streets for parking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's see. Caller, good morning. You have a comment or question?
Yo, what's up, Carol Cox?
Oh, not much, my friend.
What's up, yo? What's up, Nashville? We got some new music. Nashville, Country 975. What's up, man?
All right. Thank you. I gave you your 5 minutes of fame. All right.
So, Carol, what has to be changed is the parking requirements for a single-family dwelling, basically.
Right.
It should have, if you have a two-story building, dwelling, it should be 3 parking spaces, for example. If you're 1-story, then it's 2 parking spaces at the minimum.
Mm-hmm.
Not half a parking space.
or a simple fix is that the mayor, under his administration, utilize and be more aggressive and applying the law.
Right.
That, I mean, I don't believe that the law needs to be reviewed or even just enforced what it is. You go there and you see if you take a tape measure and you see that you submitted an application to erect a fence, you require a building permit.
Right.
That's what it's called, a building permit. To lay cement of certain size, you need a building permit. You go there, when was this laid? Okay, let's look at your plans. Well, it didn't exist 6 months ago. You put this in. Where's your building permit? Very simple. We're citing you, and you must remove it out. We're not going to give an after-the-fact permit. But speaking of after-the-fact and all, what is the process? Apparently, it is, even when they are aggressive in enforcing the law or the codes, taking legal action, you still can work around it because you can keep dragging it out. So they've authorized, they come and they look at it and they cite you for the violation.
Mm-hmm.
And every day that violation exists, you get charged. And there's sometimes they say $10,000 a day. I'm exaggerating, but let's say $1,000 a day, $500 a day. And okay, the person says, well, and then all you got to do is just wait that out.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to bring foreclosure to your property? No, they're not. They're going to send you a notice that you, what is the term when you don't pay the fine, it a notice of action. They have to submit it to the corporate council. Corporate council then decide what they're going to do, if they're going to then attach a lien to your property.
Yeah, the lien. And basically, if they're building a dwelling, or whether it be a brand new dwelling or extension, there should be a
cease and desist.
Yeah, in terms of any more construction.
Right.
And that should be enforced.
Right.
Quite frankly.
And they
but
don't.
For old dwellings, whereby you discover that it was properly done, then basically you want to give a deadline in terms of when they got to be amended, the building structure. I mean, if you don't get a building structure, then a suit will encounter.
I suspect that not only are the, we see the lack of money being utilized or expended as it's being authorized or approved by the council on the mayor's part, I also believe that our corporate council is being taxed by the rail issues, having to assemble teams to take on issues relating to the rail.
Right,
and
right.
Therefore, they don't have the time to take action against the violators if, in fact, you can't, this monster, you have inspectors out there walking around inspecting and citing and issuing citations and notice of order, I guess, is what they, and then you get fined, and each day the fine increases. And but you need the corporate council involved eventually.
Right, and then this probably
and if they're
true.
Too busy
right.
working on the rail, then maybe that explains to some degree why we have such a dysfunctional process of enforcement and regulating building codes.
That's partly true, but it is also the underside of it is that, by and large, if a person who has a law degree and is an attorney wants to work for government, they will take that opportunity to work for government. And why? Because you're not accountable for your hours.
Mm.
Okay? As compared to the private sector, it's billable hours. Anybody who's an attorney that works for a city or a state is not accountable for their hours. Now, mm-hmm. case in point, remember that guy Chuck Tuttle,
mm-hmm.
who was the administrator executive for the Ethics Commission of the city?
Mm-hmm. And Consumer Affairs or something
right,
like that.
Right, yeah, before that. And then basically what it is, he was overzealous and in his investigation, he would improperly notify the public, like a harassment, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I could see where former chief, Ke Aloha, is suing him, because he improperly notified everybody of an allegation,
mm-hmm.
which was
mm-hmm.
not concluded yet.
And we see the same thing in the
right.
building permit.
So what happened is, when they went, when the Ethics Commission... when the Ethics Commission started reviewing Chuck Tuttle's performance, they said, hey, you don't have any concreteness on your hours of operations. So they started saying, okay, every 7 minutes or so before you got to log down what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And he didn't like that because he could play around, quite frankly,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they take extra lunch and so forth. But ironically, he was the one who went after the city employees for... not diligently doing their job, but he in turn was doing it. By the way, he's being investigated by the State Ethics Commission of misuse of his credit card.
PC card.
Yeah, right.
P card.
Okay. Yeah, and I don't know why he was given a P card, because he doesn't have to embrace any expenses. He can order his office supplies by purchase order. But
I haven't heard about that.
It's being done right now. And guess what? You know who's representing him, I was told? Is Peter Carlisle, former mayor, and also who was that? Henry Walker, grandson,
Lindsay.
Yeah, Michael Lindsay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and basically they trying to prevent him from being testifying on his investigation. He's running away, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we got some interference.
Yeah.
That you could hear it.
Oh yeah.
So anyway, this thing with the rail, and I believe it's all directly related.
Oh yes.
And the lack of enforcement, and because once you take an action, legal action, at the level of the inspector,
mm-hmm.
then you have yourself a problem.
Right. Right.
With the process, due process, or the person has a right to appeal or object or contest it, and can have a contested case, I would think. He doesn't have to, just because you're fined, you have to accept that.
Hmm.
So who in the corp council is going to be available to represent that case? So the best way to do it is don't create any cases. Therefore, you won't be taxing or placing a demand on the corporate council so that they can mine the rail issues.
Well, it's a general old saying, basically, that those who work for the city as attorneys are lazy because
mm-hmm.
they don't have to be accountable for their hours. And then also it's a guaranteed salary,
mm-hmm.
right? And also a guaranteed retirement system, too.
Caller, you have noise. Hello?
Hello?
You have some noise there. You got to turn down your radio or phone. You there? Hello? Don't know what's happening here, but anyway.
Oh.
Caller, go ahead.
Hello?
Okay. Anyway, don't bother calling back because you're calling from a line that just is substandard or something. That sounds like he's in a well there. So
you know what has need to be done is basically, I understand, first of all, I understand that the city council is trying to relate to this problem amongst their homes. Mm-hmm. But their problem is that they're not asking the administration, the investigators, how the whole system works in terms of violation of the building code. Once they start doing that, then they can have legislation if needed to. But without that, they're just guessing work, mm-hmm. right? I remember when I was a city councilman, and I had to deal with the bed and breakfast homes, okay, and vocational units. And what happened is I called upon the administration, and I wanted to have a meeting with the Department of Planning Permits, and I said, not only the director, but I want to talk to the investigators. And I said, why the investigators? I said, well, I need to learn what's going on. What are the violations and so forth? So how do you guys attend to it? And it was very helpful. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, the legislation didn't pass. We put in restrictions and so forth, and that you can't do these bed and breakfasts in vocational homes. But what happened, and there was too much politics involved in terms of those for and against. And so some of my colleagues, they didn't want to take the chance in terms and at that time of making the decision. They were scared because they wanted to get voted back in office.
Yeah. You know, I observed one of the best political speeches in preparation and delivery that I witnessed in the state of Hawaii in the last 29 years that I've been here. I saw that, witnessed that the other day. And it was given by Ikaika Anderson.
Mm.
Full of hot air. I mean, it was so eloquent, and his delivery was, I thought, wow, I'm impressed with just the delivery itself. And it went on to talk about him changing the law and beefing up the law about monster homes and what have you. And I'm thinking, why don't you just tie that horse to the post, hitching post over there, walk back to the issue, and just take what is existing in place now and follow through with those laws. If you have no building permit, and if you've erected it, and but I mentioned that because of you mentioned politics.
Right.
And it seems that maybe it's just me and my interpretation is that for every issue there is, they don't get done until someone decide, I can use that. I can ride that to the front line. I can bolster my race or my efforts to become a chairman of this or the city council or the senator. Instead of just doing the work and then let the people judge them by the lack of conflict and the lack of tall buildings and the lack of water running down, or they build a culvert and now you're told, well, that's between you and the neighbor. But the way it's structured is that the channelization of the water, he built a wall there, the water is going to come down on my property. See, here's the video, here's the pictures. And the city says, well, you guys will have to.
Oh, the city is wrong because you're not supposed to. The law says that you're not supposed to let runoff water into a neighbor's property.
Right.
You know, the days of before when you had a stone wall or hollow tile wall, you had the drainage pipes that go into people's property, it's no longer acceptable.
Right.
Right.
You stick the hole in the pipe in the wall, and then just drain everything down to your neighbor's yard.
Yeah.
Mililani is that way.
Right.
You know.
you mentioned that there was a case when I was a senator right in Paltwood Valley. From the Pacific Heights to bottom of Pa'o Road, or Booth Road, actually, whereby the runoff water was from a city drainage system onto the person's property down below. And the city refused to do anything. It was eroding like crazy.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a case of no excuse to the city, quite frankly. Because they were waiting for somebody to sue them, but they know that most people won't sue because they don't have the money.
Right? Yeah, they have a free cadre of lawyers, and you as a homeowner have no lawyer struggle to afford one. So what's the benefit to that? Why, I mean, they tell us about this, what they're doing so much and how much they care about us. Why abandon the care for us when it comes to managing property, enforcing rules? But let's say this building on Date Street, this monster, and Cuneo out in those areas where these monsters are being built, what if someone loses their life? Is the city responsible?
Well, basically, you have to have a smart attorney that knows about the structure and process of government. And not too many attorneys know that, quite frankly.
But, I mean, the enforcement, you know the city has a responsibility of enforcing the laws.
Right.
And approving certain activity. And when, because the regulations exist and the codes exist. Already.
Right.
And would it be are they complicit in this by failing not to take action?
Yeah, it's a failure of the city.
Because they acknowledge that the building is there. They're taking money for the regular taxes or whatever. And I would be curious to know that how much taxes, are these big monsters being taxed, you know, by square footage?
They're supposed to be your property tax is based in terms of land area, square footage, and your dwelling.
Right.
Right. And then also, too, there's another thing is market value. Okay. And then there's one more item in terms of any type of renovations if you have existing dwelling.
And so this monster starts to grow. You would think just the city would go to that building anyway just to see that, well, what is about our revenues? The square footage is increasing. The value of the home is increasing. The tax value of benefit to the city becomes higher.
Right.
So there's either they're taking part in what benefits them, or basically they just fall down on the job, period, 100%.
Yeah. And once again, I'm not trying to make excuse for the inspectors out there, because I met with some of them. And they have a job that's very cumbersome, whereby time-consuming. And they have to go to within the different geographical areas that they assign and review. But when you have so many complaints, it's hard to keep up. Again, the mayor has to release money to hire more building inspectors, and he's not willing to do that.
But that's not his...
Well, you know, basically the mayor is the one who is a political animal too, yeah?
Yeah.
And he's going to say, yeah, I sympathize with you and so forth, and they want to do this, you need to do some kind of legislation. But the legislation doesn't do anything because, like you said, it has to be an investigation. Mm-hmm. But how can you investigate if you don't have enough manpower to really do it?
Or you tell the manpower that you do have, don't clog up the system, don't introduce any cases. If you get complaint, go there, give them the nod once or twice, yes, 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 and leave.
Yeah.
And you and the homeowner have met, you go back and write a little note in that you went there, everything looks okay, you talk to the homeowner who was the offending homeowner, and they were told they need to provide certain documents, and you never hear anything more.
Yeah, right. And it's a matter of timing. How long does it take to follow through with a violation? In fact, you know, when there's a violation of a building code, you know, an inspector goes there, and he cannot enter the property unless he gets permission. So the landowner can delay and delay. Now, it's up to the inspector to go file in court that he wants to go into the property. And to a matter of court order, basically.
Okay. How getting in contact with an inspector is almost like pulling chicken teeth. You know, early morning, you might get one.
Right.
In the evening, after 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, you're in the doldrums. It's been my experience, they're not available.
Right.
So I'm trying to find the logic of that when, you know, you try to call them up. And many of them are hostile when you call them up and then, well, why are you looking into it? Look, the people call and ask, and I have a question about the property. Right. Well, you know, call this guy.
Okay, the best thing to do, if I may, because of I studied the structuring process of the administration. Okay, mm-hmm. The best thing to do is not to call the Department of Planning and Permitting, but call the Mayor's Office of Information and Complaint.
Okay,
and they will have to log it down. Mm-hmm. Okay, to get hold of an inspector is very difficult. Like you said, they're on the road inspecting in terms of
violation. On the road or on the run,
right? but then, you know, basically, you call the Mayor's Office of Information Complaint, and they have to log down everything, okay? Mm-hmm. And it's up to them, basically, to be timely about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you don't have a good director for that office, they're going to have problems, quite frankly.
Right, okay.
Okay. Yeah.
So, before we go, what about the rail and its... there's an audit being planned.
Right.
And just authorize the judge, the former judge, and the former police officer, of high-ranking police, I don't know, deputy chief or something like that.
Yeah. Well, the whole issue...
What's going to come out of this?
Well, the whole issue is focused on financial accountability. When I established and helped establish an association called Financial Accountability Rail Mass Transit Association, we had to follow up in terms of all these complaints about finances. So I looked at it and said, you know, we need a terminology that will be very clear and understandable to everybody that they can focus on, because they mentioned in terms of all these different problems with dealing with finances. So being that my background is a budget analyst previously before being an elected official,
mm-hmm.
I came up with a terminology of financial accountability, which is a terminology that's not made up, basically. It's there. It's been there for decades or years, okay, historically. Okay. Then what happened is you had a Senate Bill 4, which became Act 1 in August of 2018, special session of the state legislature. And what they did, they passed the bill whereby $2.4 billion in addition to funding the rail construction based on in terms of the 0.5% excise tax. That Bill 4 also extended the 0.5% general excise tax surcharge to the year 2030. Okay? And then it also increased the state of Hawaii hotel room tax by 1% for 13 years. So there's more than enough money. But the mayor keeps on saying there's not enough money. Mm-hmm. So you have to question in terms, what is this? Where's the financial accountability? And the Bill Ford also said there got to be an audit. An audit by the state auditor to oversee this. Okay?
Now, are we going to get a bona fide audit, or are we going to get one that they do the audit, then they're going to sequester themselves in a private room before the public get to see it, and then they have an executive meeting, you know, the standard practice approach of many things here in the city or the state? Or are we going to see it in real time when they finish their results?
Mm.
Will the public get to see the results of this audit?
Well, first of all, you asked a very good question.
In a timely, mm-hmm. contemporaneous method, rather than we get it third hand, redigested and
Yeah, so you initially you've asked a very good question, whether it's going to be a true audit, mm-hmm. financial audit. People have asked me, why don't we have an independent person doing an audit?
Period.
Right. In other words, the state of Hawaii would hire our CPA firm, mm-hmm. and investigate, right? A special investigator, and rather than the state auditor. Well, You know, by the wisdom, I say by the wisdom, because I don't know what is called wisdom anymore sometimes. The state legislature decided to have the state auditor audit the city on the finances of the rail. But on the basis that the construction, okay, so what happened is you had Les Condo, who is the state auditor, started to do that of last year in September or so. And he hired certain people, like he hired the former judge Ronald Lee, who was a prosecutor before and so forth. Now, the problem with this is, I was surprised, is that there hasn't been any interim, public hearing on it, display. Okay. And this recently I found out last week to the newspaper, which is very sad to say, that Hart Board, H-A-R-T, Hart Board of the city, decided to have a public hearing and invited Les Condo. And then when he went to display things, they closed the hearing, the meeting. Executive meeting. That's terrible. What have you got to hide, quite frankly?
And that's not to say the Judge Randall Lee and not to even suggest that they would be participating in cover-ups. I'm just concerned that with the general practice of what we've come to learn or expect is that they have these grandiose audits and they spend the money and, you know, the new sheriff hops on the white horse and then all of a sudden, what happened? Oh, we're going to a private meeting. And that taints it, in my opinion, as a citizen.
Actually, that's illegal for them to have an executive meeting because I looked at it in terms of the HRS, Chapter 92. Exemptions. It does not allow them to have a closed meeting unless it's a personnel matter, basically, or it's a legal matter. Okay, all the state auditor was doing is disclosing what he's been doing and finding an interim. By the way, what he found real fast in the interim is that there's a difference of interpretation on the use of the funds for the rail. The rail money, it was just budgeted, basically, was for construction only. Now, the question is, where is the money coming from for the administration costs? Okay? Which is supposed to be separate from the construction. And so, I see in terms of a misuse of the construction money. That's why it has exploded, per se. So, the city is at fault. And a good thing now that the Bill 4 also says that the oversight on the day-to-day basis of the expenditures is by the comptroller of the state of Hawaii.
Well, thank you for
that. Oh, one more thing, real fast. I'm going to file a complaint with the Office of Informational Practices in terms of this closed meeting with an attempt in terms of having a public hearing coming up. Okay, I have here a petition drive to, and also a flyer. And you can call me, Rod Tam, at 216-5454.
Okay, and your email is, if they want to contact you.
Yeah, my email is r.tam@hawaii.rr.com.
All righty. Okay. Well, thank you, Rod Tam, and we're going to bring this show to a close for this hour. We'll be back in the next hour, and hopefully we get good communications talking about observers aboard the international fishing fleets. And some of them are reportedly coming up missing and falling overboard and what have you. There's an organization that's concerned with the manner in which these things matters are being handled. So we'll take that on, and Ms. Liz Mitchell from Eugene, Oregon, is calling in. So we'll see, and again, thanks, Rod Tam, for joining me.
Well, thank you, Carol.
All righty, and we will talk to you later, and just hold on. We're going to take a break. We'll be back shortly. Okay, hey, good morning again. Welcome to the Carol Cox Show. Sitting here with Rod Tam for the last few minutes here, we wanted to have a carryover on one topic we wanted to chat with you. And that is regarding trespassing on private property.
Yes.
And so go ahead.
Okay.
And
Well, I just want to give a public information announcement to all the listeners out there and to the general public that everybody should have a no trespassing sign on their property.
Right.
And because what happened is makes you liable, responsible, if you do not, if anybody comes into your property and get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it's very important because our state takes it as whereby you are liable. But you didn't give notice if you don't have a no trespassing sign on your property.
A hostile act or some expression or something.
And you have to defend yourself. Even if you have a burglar come to your property, they get hurt. They trip.
You weren't invited. Get out.
You weren't invited. And so because you didn't have the no trespassing sign on your property or your driveway, basically, you're responsible according to the law.
Or if you have property on the Big Island and you live on Oahu and someone comes to your property on the Big Island and camps out.
Right.
I don't know how you still got to go through the legal challenges of removing them. Mm. But if you've made no hostile act or expression saying stay out, no trespassing.
Right. And that's the issue of eminent domain. Somebody who stays on your property for a period of time, according to law, can claim ownership, frankly.
Homesteading.
Right, homesteading, yeah. By the way, I know of a case in point whereby I've read several times where the U.S. Post Office has a very interesting interpretation on entering somebody's property, even if it's private. Mm-hmm. They say that the mailman has a right to enter a person's property without authorization. Now, if they get hurt, the property owner is responsible. Even if you say no trespassing, and if the road conditions are bad and they get hurt on the road walking, you are liable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Wow.
Also, too, what it is that they make the postman liable too by saying it's your fault you got hurt. So, therefore, if you get hurt, we're not going to pay you workers' compensation if you take off from
work.
Wow. Yeah. It's a catch-22 for the homeowner, property owner, and also for the postman. So the best thing to do is notify your post office here in Hawaii, state of Hawaii, that you do not want the postman to enter your property, nor should you have your mailboxes on private property.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It should be on a public access road. Okay.
Right. Okay.
So that's what I want to say.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks for holding over. We'll see you next time.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Hey. Rod Tam.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
time for the Carol Cox Show right here at K108. If you have questions or comments for Carol, our number here is 524-1080, 524-1080. And now, here's Carol.
Okay. Hey, welcome back to the second half of the Carol Cox Show. Thank you for joining me. Carol at carolcox.com is where you can pick us up on the Internet and look at all the old shows. And KWAI1080AM.com, and you can go there and pick up other shows here on KWAI1080AM. So as I said to you, we'll have Miss Liz Mitchell calling in from Eugene, Oregon, and we're going to be talking about the well-being or the not-so-well-being of the fisheries observers. And so we're going to be talking about the disappearance and or death of fisheries observers. So let's see if we can get a clear connection here. Good morning, Liz.
Hi.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
I'm good, and thank you for calling in. And I got just a little buzz there in the background, but that's okay.
Uh-oh.
No problem.
Okay.
Yes. So, can you introduce yourself and tell us what we're going to be talking about and this concern with the fisheries observers?
Yeah, my name is Liz Mitchell, and I work for the Association for Professional Observers based here in Eugene, Oregon. We have been dealing with a several fisheries observers who have disappeared in the last, few years.
Uh-huh.
So it's a challenge to get information. So that's what we've been doing.
Yeah. And this concern that you have, and I do apologize. I don't know why it went south on us with this sound, but we'll make do. And
Okay. Now,
when we talk about observers, can you explain what this observer program is? Because we do have had an observer program in the local fleet of longliners, but we're talking mostly about foreign entities, primarily that do purse seiners and dealing with transfer ships or what is it called, the term?
The transshipment observers.
Transshipment vessels. So,
yes.
Well, let's just start off, and what's the most recent concern with an individual observer that, and tell us some background on that.
Okay, we had someone from Ecuador, an observer, 27 years old, on an Ecuadorian vessel, disappeared. It's still under investigation. That was March 6th, just last month. Before that, James Jr. Numbaru from Papua New Guinea. He was the fourth observer to have disappeared from that country. That was on a purse seine vessel. Most of these are on purse seine vessels. There's a couple of PNG observers that disappeared in 2015 and 2016 who, there's no information. And so we hear about these things, but there's a lockdown on the information.
Mm-hmm. And when you say lockdown, that meaning that the agencies, and these are foreign agencies as well, is there any U.S. government agencies involved, like NOAA?
Yes.
Go
ahead.
And what is NOAA's role? Let's say, do we have a concern for any incident where it involved, what type of fisheries did it involve, and also the individual, and when did it happen, and one was related to shark finning at one time, correct?
Yeah, it's somewhat related, though we don't have the exact details from that.
Well, tell me what you know about it.
Pardon me?
Yeah, go ahead and tell us what you know about how it involves or relates directly, indirectly then.
Okay. Usaya Masabalavu from Fiji died the 21st of May 2016 on board a U.S. Purseine vessel. It started out as a knee injury and developed into an infection. That's all we know.
Mm-hmm.
He was, by the time the vessel called in for assistance and was on their way to drop him off, he died.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a U.S. vessel. The U.S. did an investigation, but there was no report about this investigation. So, you know, for all of these disappearances, there has never been an official report from the authorities in charge regarding the circumstances surrounding the deaths of these observers.
Now, you there were some concerns, or a little emphasis should be put on the prior activity of previous activities of this person. Can you tell us, was he not involved in the reporting and documenting the illegal action or the actions of where it involved, or what did it involve, and why is it?
Okay. Yeah, okay. Yes, he was on a previous vessel, a U.S. vessel, and he apparently had reported some shark finning or evidence of shark finning
mm-hmm.
on board that vessel. That agency, the Pacific Islands Forum Fisheries Agency, reassigned him to that same vessel, which should never have happened.
Mm-hmm.
And he refused to get on board. The NOAA officials in American Samoa intervened, I guess, and got him reassigned to the vessel where he ended up dying.
Mm-hmm.
So
because there's a little bit of noise in the back, what you're seeing, in essence, is that what took place was that this gentleman was working on an American vessel, fishing vessel, Purseiner, correct?
Yes.
And then in turn, he observed what he thought to be the unlawful take of a shark fin, a participation practice of taking shark that were caught in the nets and they were shark finning. And he reported that as he's supposed to. And then once he reported it, I guess it would be to NOAA, right?
No, he reported it to FFA.
Okay.
I don't really know for sure, but
okay.
I'm assuming that since he was an FFA observer, that he would have reported to FFA first.
Okay,
then,
so he would then referred it to FAA, informed them of his observations. They, in turn, took the information and then later on assigned him to that vessel, that same vessel, again for another trip.
Yeah.
And then he refused. Then he went out on another American flag vessel, I guess.
Yes.
And then in turn became injured, a knee injury that it had infected, and you're saying that he then subsequently died from that injury.
Yes.
And
we're not certain how much time lapsed between his injury and the proper medical attention that he received,
mm-hmm.
or what medical attention he received from the boat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is it the penalties that severe that let's just assume, we don't know this to be factual, that if what his specific cause of death was, but is it, do we have the liberty to think or explore that him reporting that would lead to the cause of his death? Is it that the penalties that severe that the company would lose so much that they'd be willing to cause harm or inflict harm or what have you to an observer?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty common that vessels in that region, they've been accused of being medically neglectful of crew members, and we're assuming that observers are no different.
Mm-hmm.
So that happens fairly often,
mm-hmm.
I've heard, although there's no statistics on it, nobody's reporting on it, at least publicly. I'm sure they have a great, file on this internally at various agencies, but publicly, no.
Mm-hmm.
It's not being reported.
And this gentleman's name was, again, that we were talking about, this observer.
Usaya Masabalavu.
Right. Now, you share with me in 2010 of March, Charlie Lasisi of Papua New Guinea disappeared on board of the tuna purseine vessel, Dolores flagship, and give the longitude, latitude where he was. And Mr. Lasisi is reported to have been taking photos of illegal trade with Indonesians. Six crew members were charged with murder but were released. Authority of Philippines, Papua New Guinea National Fisheries Authority, NFA. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about that one?
It's always the same in all these cases, is that you get the statements from the crew, and then they're conflicting, and they were accused of murder, but the Papua New Guinea National Fisheries Authority and the police did not consider the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And so they released the crew members, and
mm-hmm.
nothing happened.
Mm.
And then I heard that his body was found somewhere else, and it's just
mm-hmm.
lots of different stories about what happened to him.
But so
nothing official.
So it sounds like that this program, if nothing else is lacking, is the information, and something as critical as someone's dying. The information, the story being told, should be very simple to do. The facts. I mean, and you're saying that there's a difficulty in getting that information,
Absolutely, it's impossible. I mean, it seems impossible, and it's very frustrating because you write these agencies, and this is, this is of public interest.
Mm-hmm.
The fish is ending up all around the world,
mm-hmm.
in our supermarkets, in our restaurants, etc. And the public has the right to know. The observers are the ones who are ensuring that they're complying to sustainable fisheries practices.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have authority, but they are reporting on it, and they're the only link to the public about the fish that ends up on their plate.
And now this whole observer effort is part of an effort. Let's say we don't have any reason to say that it's not, but a part of a quote legitimate effort to monitor the fishing activities, the take of the species, the quantity, and basically that observer gets that information and gives it back, and then it is crunched, those numbers are crunched, and then that allow the authorities from these various authority nations or programs to set limits or set whatever it takes to say that it's sustainable. Is that right?
Yes, and also to judge whether these member states are complying with the international agreements.
So if someone is there on board the vessel and not, quote, playing or turning their head and looking the other way or writing things down. So when I'm an observer, let's say, as an example, using me for an example, I go aboard the vessel. I'm either contracted by a private contractor service that provide head for observers, or the authority itself has a program, like we have a program here. I had one on the NOAA, correct?
Yes.
And so I go aboard and I get the information, and then I write it down. Am I allowed to, in many of these situations, am I allowed to send that information directly to another source or third party, or do I have to go through the captain?
You have to generally go through the captain, which is one of the reasons why the Western and Central Pacific Regional WCPSC, the commission, tuna commission, in the Western Pacific. They implemented last year some measures that were supposedly to protect observers, including a two-way communication device that allowed the observer to communicate directly with the his supervisor and to send an emergency signal if need be. But I'm finding that that has not been implemented by these various agencies. So it's not working.
Right. Wow.
And that's, and IATTC, which is the Eastern Pacific Tuna Commission, they have refused to even implement those at an international level. The member states have blocked it. So none of these commissions, besides the WCPSC, have implemented these safety measures. And so all around the world, these tuna fisheries, the observers are reporting directly, well, they're reporting through the vessel's communication, either the captain's email or whatever.
Mm-hmm. So then the transfer ships, how does that work? There was a gentleman that was observed activities above that, aboard those vessels. You mentioned, and also while you said in the information that was provided with me, the December 2010, a Korean, unknown Korean national, the vessel Insung number one sunk and the observer died along with 20 crew members. A New Zealand coroner blamed negligence as a case of sinking, a cause of sinking. And authorities, Korean Commission for the Conservation of Antarctic Marine Living Resources. What's with that one, if you could?
Well, again, no information from the authorities, no publication of what happened, no name. You know, the observer is, as always, anonymous. I don't know much about that incident, except that they did an investigation, the New Zealand authorities did an investigation and found the vessel to be negligent, but I don't know what happened to the vessel.
In March 2012, there was a gentleman named Chris Langle, you indicate, a West Coast observer. Chris was working on board the U.S. fishing vessel Lady Cecilia. When the vessel disappeared, authorities, the USA National Marine Fisheries Service and Service, what happened with that one? It was just sinking?
The boat sank, and there was no cause. They investigated it. The Coast Guard investigated it and didn't find a cause. I think they did find the vessel, though. As far as I know, and I might not have all the information, but I don't think they knew what happened. But that the vessel sank.
So, what transshipment? Can you explain what happens in there? It's not a fisheries per se. It's just one tactic or strategy of the vessels that feed to the transshippers. Can you explain that process? And then, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay, so the transshipment, these long-line vessels are fishing all over the world, and rather than go into port to offload their catch, which costs a lot of time and money, they meet these transshipment vessels out at sea, and it allows them to stay out there indefinitely. These transshipment vessels coordinate crew changes, traffic of human cargo, you know, they just supplies, and they transfer the fish from the longliners to the reefer, which is another name for the transshipment vessel. And then they go to port eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a problem for illegal fishing because those fishing vessels can fish anywhere, legally or illegally. They can do whatever they want, and there's no record of it. The only record is the bundle of fish that can't be identified by the observer,
mm-hmm.
Because they have all their identification features removed,
mm.
And they come and, you know, they don't have open access to this fish, like they can't stop the operation.
Right.
So the data is lousy,
mm-hmm.
and it goes, the fish transfer over to the reefer vessel, and then the boat, the longline vessel, goes fishing with its new replacement crew.
Now, when we say longline, is any of the American longliners participating in that type of delivery?
I'm not really sure.
Okay. Because I know that in years going back, by the there were motherships, we call them, or transshippers,
mm-hmm.
would actually do just that and pick up the shark fin by the thousands of pounds.
Oh,
and,
I'm sure.
And
yeah.
then in turn, they would offload fuel and rice and food, and that vessel would go back fishing. Not American
yes.
vessel, but foreign vessels. And in turn, we'll pull in shore here and replenish, loaded with shark fin. And then at one time, U.S. Customs was allowing them to offload the shark fin here in Pier 1.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, it's. So let me ask you this. Can, with this kind of treatment of the observers, and we'll talk some more about it, should we trust the foreign vessels or this whole effort, this observer program? What's your personal opinion?
No, right now, I don't trust any of the data. I just gotten so much obstruction, and, you know, it's just like a secret club, these
mm-hmm.
tuna commissions. They're not transparent. They don't allow any observers into their compliance committee meetings, and they don't have any authority, really. I mean, they don't do anything to address any issues. If a vessel is reported by an observer, you know, to have committed a violation or harassment or whatever, it might make it to the committee meeting, you know, information, like a report the following year, and nobody ever follows up on it, and the vessel just goes right back out.
Mm.
And several of these disappearances, vessels have just turned right around and gone right back out again with another observer, and it's just business as usual. So I'm about reaching my limit.
So the observer program, having an observer aboard your vessel, basically could be interpreted as just a get out of jail card, or a way of you having on board, but he has to submit it to the captain, his observations, and then in turn they say they are complying because they have an observer and they can operate. You saying that possibly illegal activities go on and under the umbrella of observer program?
Yes. I mean, there's no protections for these observers. They say that they're protecting them with these measures, but when the word from the ground is that they're not being implemented.
Mm-hmm.
They're not being given the equipment, and if you're out there and you're witnessing this stuff, and you don't have anybody backing you up, what are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one reason why I don't trust the information coming out of these commissions is because observers just don't have protections.
Yeah. I was thinking, I was remembering that show, The World's Deadliest Catch, or the Deadliest Catch. This seems to be rising to that level. For example, you mentioned Keith Davis, of the United States citizen, disappeared on board a Panama-flagged International Intertropical Tuna Commission transshipment vessel, and during a 500-mile off-coast Peru from Taiwan, longline vessel Chang Kuo. Though the vessel is owned by a Panamanian company, they are Taiwanese operated and transshipped from Taiwanese longline vessels owned by a company in Taiwan, Galantis Ocean Group. What happened to Keith Davis? Is there any concerns about his death?
We have an investigation. We think he was murdered. Panama, they had 10 days to scrub the vessel of any evidence on their way into Panama. And we thought that the U.S. and, everybody descended on their FBI, State Department, Interpol. Lots of officials went to Panama to meet this vessel, and at the last minute, Panama said, "No, you guys, hold off. We're in charge." And so they did the investigation. They found that no foul play, and the vessel, even before that investigation was finished, went right back out again, and within 2 months. Less than 2 months, the whole system was back and running.
Mm.
And so then last year, I can't remember what date the Panama came out with their conclusion. They didn't produce a report. FBI and the Coast Guard. Closed the case, didn't produce a report. Keith's father hired a private investigator, and he's currently working on that.
Mm-hmm. So there's another gentleman, Josh Sheldon, United States, became unconscious on 16 March 2016 while working on board a longline fishing vessel as an observer, NIMS. Pelagic Observer Program in the Southeast region. What happened to him? He was unresponsive and threw a series of calls to shore, but not a mayday. What happened to him?
He went on a pelagic longline vessel, and I'm not sure where they were fishing, but it was in U.S. waters in the Southeast. And he apparently was sick when he... he got sick when we're not sure if he developed the sickness before or from the vessel, but they went out to the fishing grounds and he was unresponsive. They tried to wake him for the first haul or the first retrieval of the longline set, and he was unresponsive, and the vessel called the fish buyer, and the first thing you do when someone's unconscious is you make a mayday, or
Oh, you don't call the fish. You're saying you don't call the fish buyer. You're supposed to call mayday when there's a person near death or that you suspect is dead.
Well, I would think so.
Oh, okay, maybe. No, yeah. I shouldn't sit here and make poke fun of that, but is it that bad?
They made the call to the fish buyer. The fish buyer called NIMS, the National Marine Fisheries Service, the observer program. It went back and forth. There was a communication problem because this was a Vietnamese national boat, U.S., mm-hmm. flagged. But the captain was saying that the observer sweeping, you know, and they just didn't connect. And they went back and forth like that, trying to get this observer to talk to nymphs. And finally, nymphs called the Coast Guard, mm-hmm. and they arranged for a medevac. And the observer died in the hospital.
Wow.
So, I mean, those, you know, and no information about how, you know, what went on that vessel, how much time, you know, passed before they knew there was a problem and the medevac. So every second counts out there when you're, you know, if there's an infection or something like that,
mm-hmm.
It's very critical that, you know, you have the proper protocol in place.
Yeah, sound like
I'm hoping that there'll be some lessons learned there.
If you're calling the fish buyer first, you and there's a person, they wouldn't. If the boat was sinking, they wouldn't call the fish buyer first.
No.
They would call the Coast Guard or EPIRB or something. They'd send out an emergency, and so I guess what I would ask you is that basically, can you point out some of the things that you want to see change? At least let's talk about the communication. A full-blown investigation and a formal report submitted so that you, your organization, the family, and authorities could review that or have it at their disposal, correct?
Yes, yes,
but
absolutely.
I mean,
you know, there needs to be transparency with these incidents, and not mm-hmm. just these incidents of death, but also of harassment and interference. It has to be absolutely transparent, and the follow-up, because you know, that's the only way that we can make change through, you know, different groups getting together and discussing possible solutions,
mm-hmm.
you know. But if in this atmosphere of secrecy, it's just, you know, aside from the families of these observers suffering the loss of their loved one, you know, everybody's searching for information about
mm-hmm.
it.
Now, you know, here there was a recent news, it saturated the news about slavery in the workplace on the longline vessels here and what have you. But I'm surprised with this number of deaths over the years that the organizations that were raising concern for the quote, the slave atmosphere that they describe the longline fishing boat as being in here in Honolulu or the Pacific side. Why aren't we seeing the same amount of outcry for this? Mm-hmm. Or have you had anyone reached out to you, your organization?
Oh, yeah.
And what is their take on it?
Well, they want just what I want. They want information.
But,
about,
I mean,
What
are they doing to, I mean, we had Associated Press, it rose to the level of big news. Have we had any
mm-hmm.
big news on this one?
What was the question?
Any big news on
big
exposés bringing this to the level of, because this list is
we're
frightening.
We're working on it.
Okay, well, don't mm-hmm. take too long. I might.
it hasn't happened yet.
Okay,
there's been a couple of stories, but mainly about Keith Davis. But the general, coverage of these observers, it's just almost non-existent.
There's Wesley. This is an interesting Wesley Talia. Was found in PNG, Papua New Guinea,
mm-hmm.
was found floating in a canoe by locals, cloaked in the ship's clothing of the Chinese vessel he was on. The locals reported it to the police, but the police and the National Fisheries Authority did not investigate. That was per the authority of PNGNFA. How about that one?
Okay, so there are different stories about that.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see why it's a problem that there's no transparency, because everybody, you know, different stories crop up, so you don't know what the truth is.
Mm-hmm.
But this observer was, I don't know what he was doing, but I heard that he was, it was an arrangement with the PNG, the Papua New Guinea National Fisheries Authority, and it was an illegal arrangement. In other words, they were supposed to be under, I don't really understand how that, you know, who the authority should have been, but apparently it must have been WCPFC, the commission, the Tuna Commission, which is the overarching management authority for the entire Western Pacific. But this was an illegal or improper arrangement between PNG and China. And so it wasn't an official observer program. And so some locals came across this canoe with a body, and the body was wrapped in the same clothing as the ship's clothing of the vessel he was on. They went, rather than tow the canoe for their whatever reason, they had a full canoe or something, I don't know. Rather than towing the canoe in to authorities, they told the authorities about it, and they did not go out to investigate. And then that's it. You know, no more information.
Now, I see here, I'm going to borrow this to try and support the gist of this conversation. And I, you know, a lot of it is, and I have a story to share with you about a local situation here, but this one grabs my attention. The Mr. James Jr. Numbaru fell overboard. And PNG fell overboard while working as a national observer for the PNGNFA. The vessel reported it and said that they did a 72-hour search as required under Western and Central Pacific Fisheries Commission, or WCPFC, observer safety measures. Upon searching for the vessel's movements on the Internet-based site Global Fishing Watch, which uses searchable AIS data to track vessels, APO received preliminary analysis from the organization stating that the vessel's movements indicate that they continued fishing rather than the required search. So I guess that would be quite upsetting for you, and when you're trying to simply get a, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Where does that leave you? I mean, I understand it suggests frustration. What can you share that?
Yeah. Well, we're very frustrated that a report hasn't been issued from the NFA about the circumstances surrounding his death. There was a lot of problems with the protocols that were followed. The vessel destroyed evidence. They destroyed 9 of the camera film, the film from 9 of the cameras, 9 of the 12 cameras, and of those 3 cameras that they saved, only 40 minutes each.
Mm-hmm.
And that so that to me is you know, destroying evidence.
Yeah.
I mean, and they also didn't save his shirt that he was wearing on that night, which might have had, you know, some kind of evidence on it.
Mm-hmm.
It was totally botched. they let the observer, the other observer who was with James, he was a Solomon Island observer, they let him go within 24 hours without Papua New Guinea questioning him, because the vessel went into Nauru first, and then that the police let them go within 24 hours, let the observer go. They went to Papua New Guinea for them to investigate, and the family also had their own investigators. And also the PNA that was a party to the Nauru Agreement observer, who they let go from Solomon Island, and they PNA put another observer on that boat on their way up to Pangaea before they were even investigated. So that placed that observer in danger. I mean, this vessel was basically being investigated for murder, I mean, to rule out murder, right? And that was pretty bad. And the family has received, you know, the coroner's report from PNG, who concluded that it was due to alcohol, but there's no supporting evidence besides these three clips of this film. And there's some, you know, it just doesn't, I just still have a lot of questions.
Yeah,
that's still underway, that investigation. We're waiting.
A while back I had spoken with a situation that a gentleman from Ponape was killed here. And there was they actually paid the family some monies, but what happened is that the person was reportedly, they say he was drinking, and the captain of the vessel tried to calm him down, and in doing so put his knee on his chest and caused a major compression, and he died because he was intoxicated. But they did not charge anyone with that. And I've had the occasion to speak to a number of people from Ponape and other Yap and other places that actually go on these vessels, Christmas Island and what have you.
Oh, yeah?
On some of the, they were telling me about the lipstick, the oil fish in some of that fishing industry, and how dangerous it was, and it fall overboard, and that was it, and it goes unreported.
Yeah.
So, real quick, Liz Mitchell, what is your organization again, and how can people find you? And you have a GoFundMe, do you?
We launched a GoFundMe drive for this investigator into Keith Davis's investigation. There's a possibility, you know, there was the latest observer. You know, anyway, right now it's focused on Keith Davis, and we're hoping that if he has some strong leads, and if something comes out of that, we're hoping that other, you know, other people will cooperate to do investigations into these other deaths.
Your website?
Let's see. Yeah, website, hold on. Oh, God. At apo-observers.org. It's apo-observers.org. APO stands for Association for Professional Observers, so APO-observers.
Okay.
Anyway.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then
okay.
I understand. Then what is it? They will find the GoFundMe on there. Could link to that.
We just started it, so it isn't up on our web page, but they can find it. I'll put it up there today, and I'll put it right at the top so people can find it. But that is just to, you know, get this investigation into Keith Davis's disappearance. And hopefully from there we'll be able to, you know, find some support to investigate these other deaths.
Okay. Well, thank you. And if you could send me that link, and we'll post it up on our website.
Sure.
And I know that you don't get paid for this, and you're doing it.
Oh, thank you.
And it's a reality that many of these gentlemen are exposed, women too, exposed to this. And at least there should be some dignity in generating a report. It's this human life that we're talking about. So thank you again, Liz.
Yeah, sure.
And I appreciate you calling in, and we'll talk soon.
All right, Carol.
All right,
thank
Liz
you
Mitchell.
So much.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
And how's the weather in Eugene?
Bye-bye. Oh, it's beautiful. It's spring.
Oh, it's spring. Oh, my goodness. Spring is strong. Okay.
Flowers.
All righty. Well, thank you so much. Aloha.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Well, thank you guys for listening, and thank you for tuning in. That was Ms. Liz Mitchell, APO, Association of Professional Observers. And it's a reality, folks. So your fish that you eat, it should be the people that we see a lot of it being imported in, frozen and what have you. So primarily most of this in these foreign vessels, this is how you're getting it in through Vietnam, from various other countries. And also, should you care about the welfare and the well-being of observers and the programs and the integrity? And also, it suggests that these numbers that we're relying on, if it's in this condition, maybe we need to rethink and consider or think about the, quote, sustainability that everyone's talking about. Maybe there really isn't a sustainable fisheries as we know it in the foreign fleets. We'll see you next week, and thank you for joining in. Aloha. Thank you.
This has been the Carol Cox Show, heard every Sundays at 9 a.m. on K108. Tune in again next week, Sunday at 9 a.m. to the Carol Cox Show on 1080 a.m. KWAI Honolulu.